Questioning Paul Chapter 4 Part 1 on Omos, Without an Inheritance.
To those without the Torah, I was Torahless the reason we have taken a detour into the Book of Acts, in the midst of our review of Paul's letter to the Galatians, is that Luke's historical portrait provides the best contemporaneous platform from which to judge the veracity of Shaul's writings. And now that we are here, there are many additional things we can learn, some of them surprising. Shimon, meaning he listens, but more commonly known as Peter, is going to be our star witness. He, with Luke serving as our narrator, reveals that a wide-ranging controversy had arisen between Yahusha's handpicked disciples and the self-proclaimed Apostle Paul. Not only was Shaul's message the antithesis of what Yahusha had taught Shimon, and indeed an irreconcilable conflict with Yahweh's word, the man who has come to be known to many as Paul was also claiming exclusive rights to preach his contrarian message to the world. So that we regain the perspective that has been provided by Luke, let's quickly review what had transpired before we consider the additional testimony Shimon Kephas provided to deliberately undermine and discredit the entirety of Shaul's preface.
And some, having come down from Rehoboth, were teaching the brethren that if you might not be circumcised as prescribed by Moses, you are not able to be saved. 15 verse 1, so an openly heated and hotly disputed argument, which was substantial and pervasive, arose pertaining to the individual Paulus and to Barnabas. Regarding them, they gave the order to stand up to Paulus and Barnabas, and some others among them, on behalf of the apostles and elders in Jerusalem with regard to this controversy associated with this point of dispute and inquiry. 15 verse 2, then having arrived in Jerusalem, they were acknowledged and received by the called out, the apostles, and elders. So then they reported as much as God did with them. 15 verse 4, but some important individuals steadfastly stood up, the ones now disassociated from the religious party of the Pharisees who having come to trust and to rely, said that it is a necessary requirement, it is established, right and beneficial, to circumcise individuals, not only to provide instruction as a messenger, but also to observe the Torah of Moses. 15 verse 5, so then demonstrating leadership, the apostles and the elders paid attention concerning this statement from the word. 15 verse 6, but then with considerable and extensive debate happening, the rock having stood up said to and against them, men, brothers, you all have examined the evidence, thought about it, and have come to understand that from the beginning you all chose Yahweh for yourself on account of my spoken words, listening to and considering the word of the healing message and beneficial messenger to the races and nations, and considered it to be trustworthy and reliable. 15 verse 7.
While the elders' testimony on behalf of the Torah and then Shimon's claims on behalf of everyone's shared experience with Yahweh have completely pulverized Paulus's position, Shimon wasn't finished pummeling God's foe. He continued to say,
and Yahweh, the one who knows hearts, provided testimony and spoke of having given to them the set-apart spirit just as also to us. 15 verse 8, and no one can make a distinction between us and also likewise them, in that which is trustworthy and reliable, having cleansed their hearts. Acts 15 verse 9.
This is a brilliant opening statement by Shimon Kephas, especially considering the nature of his adversary. In direct opposition to Paul's, but I say, Yahusha's disciple affirmed that, with regard to salvation, Yahweh's testimony is all that matters. Then, the rock further differentiated himself from Shaul when he identified the source of his effectiveness, the set-apart spirit, the same spirit which Yahweh had previously spoken about and had provided to his covenant children. By contrast, however, in the previous chapter, we learned that Paul's power came from a masculine spirit whom he later identified as a messenger of Satan. Also in direct contrast to Shaul, The rock said that no one should make a distinction between us and them, which was to say that the world should not be divided between Yahudim and Goim, or even into past, present, and future circumstances. All of Yahweh's spirit-filled true voters are called to share God's healing message, and to anyone and everyone, to all those whose minds are open, regardless of race, place, or time. As a result of the fulfillment 17 years earlier of the Torah's promises regarding seven Sabbaths, where the beneficiaries of Passover, unyeasted bread, and first fruits were enriched and empowered, our Heavenly Father's covenant family grew in numbers and capability. And consistent with the Torah's instructions, Goim and Yahudim, men and women, young and old, rich and poor, free and slave were all invited to participate. While there was still a distinction nationally and communally, individually the door was wide open. Regardless of ethnicity, gender, age, or economic status, the path to become Yahweh's children is the same, because there is and always has been only one way to God and one way to witness on His behalf. Therefore, Shimon asks Shaul and company a rather poignant question, one which casts Paul in the role of Satan.
Now, therefore, why do you test and tempt God, to place upon and impose a yoke upon the neck of the disciples which neither our fathers nor we were given the authority to accept, support, or put up with? Acts 15 verse 10. While it is a translation of what Shimon actually said, since this discussion would have been conducted in Hebrew, or possibly Aramaic, there is no dismissing the fact that peirozo is an unsuperior term. It is used in reference to Satan tempting Yahushua in the wilderness prior to the beginning of his witness in Mark 1 verse 13. Martonia is also translated using the same word in relation to Satan, calling him the tempter, in Martonia 4 verse 3. Then peirozo was supplied by a scribe in Martonia 16 verse 1, showing the Pharisees and Sadducees trying to tempt Yahushua, so as to manipulate him. Therefore, the disciple Shimon is implying that Shaul was acting like Satan and his religious minions in his attempt to test and tempt God, searching for mistakes to exploit and trap God. He has done so by misquoting God, and the issues at play were Torah observance, especially circumcision, and messaging, particularly the audience. So since Yahweh's instructions in this regard are clear and invariable, to claim otherwise and to expect God to acquiesce is to tempt fate. It is a losing hand, and Shimon knows it. Then Shimon said that Shaul was inappropriately trying to control Yahushua's disciples, imposing restrictions upon them which they could never support. He is in effect telling us that all of Shaul's claims regarding God changing his approach and then authorizing one man to proclaim those alterations were completely bogus. This is a refutation of everything we have read thus far in Galatians. The disciples were specifically asked by Yahushua to carry his message to the world, so they'd have to refuse God's direction to accept Shaul's mandate, and they wisely weren't willing. But beyond this, Shimon was quick to point out that Yahweh didn't give any of us the authority to change his testimony, and most especially the terms and conditions associated with his covenant. So what Paul was preaching was something the disciples could not and would not accept, support, or put up with. In the next chapter, we are going to consider another of Yahushua's prophetic warnings regarding Shaul, this one directed at Shimon, and directly germane to the rock's most recent affirmation. 17 years before Shaul would attempt to do this very thing to Shimon, Yahushua warned his disciple. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you were girding yourself, fastening the ties of your own garments, preparing yourself for work, and you were walking, traveling around, conducting, and directing your life, wherever you were intending and whenever you decided. But when you grow older, you will extend, holding out and stretching forth your hands, and another will gird you, placing a yoke on you to control you, and he will move, manipulating and driving you to a place where you do not presently intend or desire. 21 verse 18, and then this, he said, making the future clear, signifying and foretelling what kind of deadly plague he will attribute to Yahweh. And this having been conveyed, he said to him, you should choose to follow me and my way, actively engaging as my disciple. John 21 verses 18 to 19.
With Yahusha's warning still ringing in his ears, Shimon told Shaul that he would not accept his yoke. While there is no test, yoke, nor trap, nor a reference to neck, nor to the ability to endure, a burden associated with the concluding statement of Moses' public pronouncement in Deuteronomy 27 verse 26, Christian apologists in a wild and unsupported leap of faith say that Peter was referencing this verse to suggest that a person is tracked by the Torah unless they obey everything it says. But not only is that conclusion in irreconcilable conflict with Yahusha's testimony on this subject, and Yahusha's, it's not even what the Torah reveals. After saying that a person will invoke harm upon themselves if they make religious idols or images that are detestable to Yahusha, if they dishonor their father or mother, if they confiscate their neighbor's land, if they mislead a blind person, if they deprive an orphan of justice, or if they have sexual relations with a parent, animal, sibling, in-law, or if they secretly strike down a fellow countryman, or if they take a bribe which damns an innocent soul, we read.
Relationally, he invokes harm upon himself who does not take a stand with regard to the words this, the Torah's guidance, for the purpose of engaging in and acting upon them. And the entire family said, surely this is truthful and reliable. Deuteronomy 27 verse 26.
So as with most things Christians claim on behalf of their religion, the inverse of their argument is true. We are being asked to take a stand with regard to the words which comprise the Torah's guidance, thereby acting upon God's instructions. When it comes to analyzing the words themselves, there is an enormous difference between Paul's letters and the testimony found in the historical and eyewitness accounts. In the former, Paul's epistles were originally written in Greek to those who were fluent in Greek. Therefore, Paul himself selected each of the Greek words we are reading. However, the conversations presented in the eyewitness and historic accounts were all spoken in Hebrew or Aramaic, making the Greek text a translation, typically by a scribe, and often hundreds of years later, rather than a transcript. This is important because it means that, in his next statement, Shimon said Chen, mercy, not Therese, grace. Luke, who at the time was traveling with Paul, may have provided the errant rendering, but it could also have been added much, much later by a Roman Catholic scribe in the late 4th century. While there is an extant pre-Constantine manuscript of Acts, this next statement was omitted. So here we find Shimon, after telling Shaul to go to Sheol with his arrogant and condescending attitude, with his grossly inappropriate turf war which sought to anoint him Lord of the world and purveyor of the word, and with his contrarian message which conflicted with everything Yahusha said and did, in addition to everything he personally had said and done, transitioning away from Shaul and back to reality.
Nevertheless, through the mercy of Yahweh, in Yahusha, we presently trust and actively rely to be saved according to this manner, this means, and this way, the same as them. Acts 15 verse 11.
Shimon is saying what I've been saying, and he's saying it because it is what Yahweh said. God is the source of mercy. He always has been and always will be. Yahusha is simply Yahweh's delivery mechanism. When it comes to our salvation, they are inseparable. The mercy Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob enjoyed, and the means they availed themselves of it, was the same as that experienced by Shimon, Yahochanan, and their fellow disciple Jacob. There is only one God, one Torah, one covenant, one way Shimon had chosen appropriately in every case, consistently siding with God Shaul, well, not so much. His mission was to change everything, including God. Forgetting Paul's affinity for the graces for a moment, believing Yahusha hasn't saved anyone. Salvation has nothing to do with our faith. Satan believed that Yahusha was the Messiah, and he understood the merit of his sacrifice, but it didn't do him any good. Our salvation is a function of choosing to pass through the door, Passover, that Yahweh has provided, and then walk along his path from unleavened bread to shelters, trusting and relying upon Yahweh every step of the way, to life. And that's the truth. This explains why the disciples and the entire called out assembly in Jerusalem responded so coldly and unreceptively to Shaul. Sit now, meaning to hiss while holding one's peace, suggests that they were trying to disassociate themselves from Paul's message. And the more he tried to impress them, the less they were impressed.
So then the entire large assembly was actually hissing while keeping their perceptions to themselves, as they were listening to Barnaba and Paul telling the quantity and extent they performed of godly signs and wonders in and among the races and nations through them. Acts 15 verse 12.
God is not a show-off. He seldom performs miracles. It isn't his style. He prefers words. He wants us to think our way to him. It isn't about impressing us. His testimony is more than sufficient. Therefore, if Barnaba and Paul wanted to impress this assembly, they would have done so by citing the Torah, equating its message to their own, while affirming Yahweh's covenant, his invitations, and his mercy. But no, with Paul, we have to be careful lumping Barnabas in with him, because immediately after this meeting he would soon reject Paul as well. It is all about him, his magnificent message and his mighty deeds. So as a result, the assembly hissed at the self-proclaimed assassin and libertine. We must always be careful with regard to Paul, or anyone, when they claim to have produced signs and wonders. Rather than serve as proof of God's influence, they usually provide another nail in the pontificator's coffin. In Matthew 24 verses 4 to 5 and then in 23 to 24, 17 years in advance of the day they would benefit from this advice, Yahusha warned his disciples to be especially wary of the likes of anyone who would make the claims Paul has now professed. In the midst of his Olivet discourse, we find,
"And Yahusha, having responded judgmentally, said to them, 'It's important that you are observant and that you pay attention, presently being aware and perceptive, lest someone will try to cause you to wander away from the truth.'" 24 verse 4, "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I represent the Messiah,' and so many they will mislead." 24 verse 5, "Then if someone might say to you, 'Behold, here in this place, the Messiah,' or, 'In this case, over there,' you should do not think that this is trustworthy or reliable." 24 verse 23, "Because those pretending to be the Messiah and false prophets will arise and take a stand, and they will give many great signs and wonders in order to momentarily deceive and mislead, if possible, even the chosen." Matthew 24 verse 24.
In a private meeting in which only his disciples were present, and thus speaking to Shimon, Yahochanan, and Jacob, Yahusha told them to pay attention, to be especially discerning and judgmental, being observant and careful, lest someone will cause you to wander away from the truth, deceiving and deluding you. Since this warning was stated specifically to the disciples, might this someone be Paul, and the occasion be the Jerusalem summit? And if not him, who? If not then, when? I realize that Christian apologists will say that this warning was meant for others, including for us today. And by way of extrapolation, that might ordinarily be possible, except for the fact that all of the pronouns and the translated tenses suggest otherwise. Blepeat, "It's important that you are observant," was presented in the present tense, and thus was not addressing encounters nearly 2,000 years later. Further, Planian, "He will intend for you to wander away from the truth," was scribed in the aorist, which while in the subjunctive mood, reveals that the attempt to deceive and delude, would be both probable and intentional. It does not specify when the wayward and misleading individual would attempt to beguile them, but it would be them, specifically, which is why you was deployed. Also, tis, someone, is singular and masculine as is Planian, the deceiver. So I say again, if not Paul and before them at this meeting, then we have no record of who or when, rendering the prophecy either inaccurate or irrelevant. Yet with Paul at the Jerusalem Inquisition, we have Shimon's eyewitness testimony that it was precisely and accurately fulfilled. And since this is the opening statement of the Olivet Discourse, Yahusha's most comprehensive prophetic revelation, in which everything else Yahusha said has or is coming true before our eyes, I don't suspect that his first prediction was erroneous or superfluous. And by the way, there is considerable evidence to suggest that Paul's deliberate attempt to mislead prevailed. While the disciples never accepted him and are seen as his opposition, they were not nearly aggressive enough. And as a result, Paul's faith has deceived and misled billions. Since it is easy to blend Yahusha's thoughts together, let's consider them one at a time. Initially he said, "Many will come in my name," and indeed, many have, but not all of those who have claimed to represent God have been deceitful. Fortunately, or sadly, depending upon our perspective, the remedy was and remains simple, available, and infallible. Be observant and judgmental. When we exercise good judgment, when we are discerning and discriminating, based upon what we have learned by God by closely and carefully examining His Torah, we cannot be deceived and we can prevent others from being misled. This instruction was written in the imperative because God wanted us to realize that few things are as important as choosing to observe His guidance. Turning to the Torah is always the best answer. And that is where this meeting began. Turning to the second statement, the most literal rendering of Emi in the middle clause would suggest that Yahusha predicted that many people would say, "I am the Messiah." And while there have been a number of isolated notices, with the most famous being Rabbi Akiba's Shimon Bar Kokhba, and the more recent being some young moon, their victims are relatively few and are usually counted in the hundreds, sometimes thousands, but seldom millions or billions. Those who have led the most people astray, and thus more completely satisfy this prophetic warning, simply claim to represent the Messiah, which is one of Emi's most common connotations, along with exist for, belong to, and stand for. And while Paul would tell the Galatians that they had treated him as if he were the Messiah, that he died with him and thus now lives as him, and even that he should be considered the co-savior by completing Yahusha's sacrifice, more typically Shaul claims to speak exclusively for him, which is to represent him. So whether you consider Paul to have falsely claimed to be the living incarnation of the Messiah, or simply to have falsely represented him, with regard to both he was not unique. But he was unique when we consider his carnage. The billions of Christians his letters have led away from Yahweh and his Torah, who have been deceived and deluded by placing their faith in his gospel of grace, are many, by any standard. In fact, it would be hard to identify another individual who has misled more people than Paul. It is why I refer to him as the most influential man who ever lived. Second unto Paul would be Muhammad, who has also misled billions. But Allah's messenger only claimed to be the Messiah as he approached Yathrib. This brief and failed interlude came immediately following the satanic verses when his tattered reputation needed a boost. Moreover, Muhammad never spoke in the Messiah's name because he didn't know it. The Quran calls Yahusha, Isa, which is an Arabic transliteration of Isa. And Muhammad never claimed to represent the Messiah, but instead Allah. So, he would be disqualified from this prophecy. Not to mention the fact that he lived 6 centuries after the lifetimes of Yahusha's disciples. Before we move on, let's pause a moment and contemplate a most startling fact. Paul has repeatedly claimed to speak for the Messiah Yahusha, and yet in all of his sermons and in all of his letters, he only quotes him once. The lone citation is found in 1 Corinthians 11 verses 24 to 26, and even it is wrong, with Yahusha's body being broken, in addition to the bread, and forgetting to mention that the blood of the Passover lamb was shed for many for the forgiveness of sin. So how is it that a man who never once quotes Yahusha accurately can actually be his spokesman? Moreover, when we compare Galatians to Matanya or Yahochanan, where Yahusha's words and deeds dominate the text, or to Zechariah or Yeshaya, where Yahweh's words reign supreme, the juxtaposition serves to awaken us to the reality that, unlike the others, Paul was speaking for himself. Simply stated, Paul wrote as if his words were God's, and yet they seldom if ever were. Continuing with the Olivet Discourse, Yahusha's warning to his disciples was advanced 20 verses later with a prediction that Paul, alone, is known to have fulfilled. He, in perfect harmony with the prediction, claimed to have seen the Messiah twice, in one place and then in another, on the road to Damascus and then again in Arabia. The sandal still fits. And it fits Shaul exclusively, because no one else made such claims during the lifetimes of Yahusha's disciples, if ever. Also, Yahusha has returned our focus to a unique individual with this prophecy, because it is once again focused on Tiz, someone, singular. So this then begs two questions. Since Christians claim to believe Jesus, when Jesus said, if someone might say to you, behold, here in this place the Christ, or in this case, over there, do not think that they are trustworthy, why don't they believe him? And why do they trust Paul? Yahusha's next statement isn't extant in any pre-Constantine manuscript. And since we know that Matanya originally wrote his eyewitness account in his native Hebrew, we have no way to tell if the first scribe to translate his testimony into Greek, or one working for the Roman Catholic Church centuries later, wrote Pseudo-Christo, or Pseudo-Christui. The former is based upon the Christos root which speaks of the application of drugs, while the later would have been based upon Christus, meaning useful implement. The Ebionites, who formed a called-out assembly in Jerusalem under Jacob in the 1st century, were the first to propose a canon, and they claimed to have read Matanya in Hebrew. And while there are a score of credible witnesses to this fact, the oldest Hebrew manuscript in our possession dates to the Middle Ages. However, since we are considering this dire prediction in light of Paul's fulfillment of it, it is instructive to know that the Ebionites, who were first century followers of the Way, specifically excluded Paul's letters from their canon, as they considered him to be a false prophet. It wasn't until Marcion, in the early 2nd century that Paul was canonized, even promoted, as the only true apostle, bequeathed with the foreboding distinction of being God's chosen messenger. Recognizing that this eyewitness account of Yahusha's testimony on the Mount of Olives chronicled a Hebrew conversation in Hebrew, for the Greek text to read will give, Didomi, many great signs and wonders, instead of will perform signs and wonders, the underlying Hebrew word spoken on this occasion had to be nitin, to give, especially in the sense of offering and providing. It suggests that the alleged signs and wonders weren't actually performed, but were instead offered, as proof, thereby provided, as justification for believing them. So when Paul and Barnabas got up before the Jerusalem ecclesia and tried to impress them by bragging about the semen chiteris, signs and wonders, he had performed, using the exact same phrase Yahusha had warned them about, the disciples should have remembered God's prediction regarding false prophets who would take a stand and offer many great signs and wonders, and seen Paul and Barnabas as the ones attempting to play now, momentarily lead them astray, actively trying to deceive and delude them. Therefore, they should have done more than his, to have responded appropriately. Paul had failed another prophetic test, this one right before their eyes. I have always enjoyed the humor in Yahusha's approach. Here, rather than just saying that folks would rise up and arouse people, claiming to speak for him while offering signs and wonders as proof in order to deceive, he said, if it were possible, they would attempt to momentarily delude kaitos ekoktos, even the chosen. While all of us are given the opportunity to choose God based upon the Word of God, there were 12 individuals who were actually and specifically chosen by God. So by augmenting his false prophet warning with this particular hypothetical in front of this unique audience, Yahusha was elbowing his disciples in the ribs, hint, I'm talking to you, the chosen, about someone who will falsely claim to have been selected. While Paul's testimony isn't ever credible, it is nonetheless interestingly that even he associates signs and wonders with Satan and Torahlessness, doing so in 2 Thessalonians 2 verses 7-10, a conversation which we will review shortly. Therefore, even Paul fixated Christians ought to have been alarmed. And while they would not have considered the Torah, Yahweh also associated signs and wonders with false prophets and interpreters of revelations, especially with the likes of Shaul, who would eliminate the Torah and replace it with their New Testament. Remember,
with regard to every word which beneficially I am instructing you with accordingly, observe it for the purpose of engaging and acting upon it, not adding to it nor subtracting from it. Indeed, if a prophet, which is a person who claims to speak for God, stands up trying to establish himself in your midst, an interpreter of revelations, and offers and provides a sign or wonder to you, and the omen or miracle worker appears before you who has spoken thusly to you to say, "Let us go after and follow other different or additional gods which you have not known, and let us serve and worship them," do not listen to the words of that prophet or interpreter of revelations, because the test of Yahweh, your God, accordingly for you to know and understand is whether this affirms your love, relationship, and affection for Yahweh, your God, with all your heart and with all your soul. Following Yahweh, your God, you should walk with him, you should always and be respectful, and in concert with his terms and conditions, you should continually and actually be observant, consistently focus upon them, closely examining and carefully considering them, concerning his voice, and thus his proclamations and pronouncements. You should always and literally listen so that with him, you can consistently serve and always engage productively. So to him, you should always choose to cling. Therefore, that prophet claiming to speak for God or that interpreter of revelations is deadly. For indeed, he has spoken rebellious renunciations, creating a revolt which leads to disassociation and to being misled concerning Yahweh, your God, the one who led you out, descending to serve you by extending himself to guide you away from the realm of the crucibles of Egypt, speaking of human oppression and divine judgment, and the one who redeemed you, ransoming you, from the house of bondage, from servitude, from worship and from being enslaved. His desire is to seduce and scatter you from the way which beneficially, Yahweh, your God, described, providing you with a complete set of directions for you to walk in. And so, you should choose to completely remove, ridding yourself of that which is disagreeable, displeasing, and evil, malignant, mischievous, and harmful, from your midst. Deuteronomy 13 verses 1-6.
End of part 1.